The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, this is what the plan is. So I hope this will work out. You know, it is bill deadline, and we know that things are always tight. So what we're going to do, Representative Kiefer, I didn't have a chance to talk with you, but you understand what's going on with your bill. So the idea is we're going to move Representative Kiefer's bill to the Judiciary Committee today. We'll still keep the language in the omnibus bill if we need to deal with your fiscal note. That'll be the first order of business, and then we will take up the Johnson bill, and then we will take up House File 237. We will then recess and return here at 7 p.m. to vote on House File 237. Is this going to work for everybody? I hope it will. So, Ms. Slocum?
I didn't even hear you.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to let you know that the idea is that we would return here at 7 o'clock tonight. I know this is a problem, and it's short notice, but it's...
Yes, for sure.
Mr. Chair, I will be presenting a bill at
6. I understand that... And Representative Lesh will be in pensions, and other people will, and Representative Hillstrom, I'm hoping your committee will be done. And so this happens, but we will, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, just any reason for the recess if we get all done today by noon?
Well, it just, we're just going to, recess and take it up for a vote this evening. We've heard public testimony on it. I think that after reviewing the bill and having discussion about it, it's going to take longer than our committee time. So I don't suspect we will be here a lot late this evening, and we'll take a vote on it, and that'll be it.
Mr. Chair, so we're just coming back to vote?
Well, in any discussion that we have. I mean, I suspect that members are going to want to give some speeches, or some talks on it, so I would like to give everybody an opportunity to do that if you have some comments you want to make or other members have some comments they want to make. So what we'll do is we'll go through the bill today, and we can have some discussion until our committee time expires at 11:30, which is, yeah. So sorry for the inconvenience, members. Okay, so with that, Representative Kiefer, we have a quorum now, and do we have any minutes to approve or no? Okay, all right. So Representative Kiefer, can you just take 30 seconds, explain your bill, and then move it to the want? Do you have it? I'm sorry.
I don't have it in front of me, Mr. Chair, but that's fine. The bill's been heard a couple of sessions. Thank you. And it's simply increasing a penalty for repeat fifth-degree sex offenders. We're hoping that it will not cost any money and actually save money in the long run. It's got a strong bipartisan support. Thank you for a lot of the members on this committee that signed on to the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for moving this as a standalone.
Okay. This bill does have a small fiscal note, which is why we'll keep the language in the omnibus bill, but we'll move it to Judiciary, and Representative Hillstrom will hear it when?
Either Wednesday or Thursday, Mr. Chair.
Very good. So Representative moves House File 142 to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails. Okay. Representative Johnson, you're next. Representative Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Where does this bill go, Representative Johnson? Does it? It goes to Judiciary also. So the chair will move that House File 790 pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the purpose of this bill is to clarify that periods of supervised release and conditional release are to be served concurrently. And therefore, it's clear that conditional release begins when an individual is released from prison. As Mr. Diebel states in his House Reach Summary, by specifying that an offender's conditional release term begins when the offender is released from prison, the law will empower the Commissioner of Corrections to detain the offender beyond the expiration of his sentence if he violates his terms of conditional release. Now, this issue was brought forward by community corrections after recent court rulings changed how corrections are to interpret current statute. The court indicated that the current statute states that two release periods are to be served consecutively, which isn't consistent with past practice. Again, this legislation simply clarifies that supervised release period and conditional release period are to run concurrently, which we believe was the legislative intent when this conditional release language was originally passed by the state legislature. Here to say a few words in support of the bill and answer any questions is Dylan Warkentin, Director of Anoka County Community Corrections.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dylan Warkentin, Director of Anoka County Community Corrections.
Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate your taking on this bill and hearing this. I also appreciate Representative Johnson assisting with this. Really, as this is indicated, it is a loophole that's being fixed, kind of created by an appellate-level decision based on the read of the current statute. And that loophole allows an offender to potentially plan a violation and control consequences, because the consecutive nature of this particular appellate-level decision allows that person, or mandates that that person be released at a specific period of time. So they could be in the community, plan a contact with minors if they're a predatory offender, and then actually get released right at that end period. So it could be potentially be a week. My colleague in Blue Earth County, Josh Milo, indicates that a current case currently going on where an offender had contact with minors was going to be returned to the institution for prison treatment as a predatory offender, was not allowed to go into the program because it significantly shortened his period of time. Although he had 3 years total to serve, potentially, this appellate-level decision mandates that he be released in 11 months, which is the end of his supervised release period. So really, this current legislation proposed cleans up that loophole so that it's a seamless system, whereby if someone does commit a violation, a significant violation while in supervised release, their consequences can carry over into that conditional release period. And that's the way it had been applied. That's the way the Department of Corrections had seen this statute from its inception. However, the appellate level read it differently and decided differently. And so this really basically returns it to the way it was.
Okay, very good. Question to the witness. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see anything in this bill that caused me to need to see it.
Okay. And there is no fiscal note on the bill, Representative Walls? Or Mr. Walls? You want to be representative?
Mr. Chair, a fiscal note has not been requested on this bill. I had some short conversations with, I believe, courts and corrections, and I did not believe there would be a material impact.
Very good. Thank you. There are some other people who signed up to speak. Is there anybody who wishes to speak in favor or in opposition of House File 790? Okay. Any questions of the author? Then Representative Johnson, do you want to have any closing comments?
If the motion could be amended to send us the general register, that would be preferred.
So the chair will move that House File 790 be passed and referred to the general register. Any further discussion? All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? That motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
So, members, at this time, we're. Let me just give you. We're going to hear House File 237, and I've discussed this with Representative Cornish, who's the lead Republican on the committee, about the process that we're going to embark on today. So, we will go till 11:30 and recess, or whenever we're done here today, and come back at 7 o'clock. I have said that what I will do is introduce the bill and go through the bill, and you can ask questions of me or of House Counsel about the drafting of the bill. There are a couple of you have all heard this before. and but there are a couple of new provisions in there that you may have some comments about. We will then open it up. We said we'd have 12 minutes for proponents, and there's some people who have organized some discussion in favor of the bill, and then there will be an opportunity for 20 minutes for proponents and 20 minutes for opponents. And Representative Cornish, I don't know if you have anybody or if people from the audience simply want to speak in opposition. We will allot that time for it. And then we'll recess and come back tonight. You can say what you want to say about the bill. If there's any amendments, we could still offer them, since the 24-hour rule was waived. If you have any amendments to the bill, that is also allowable, and we will vote on it tonight. Representative Cornish.
We don't have any amendments, Mr. Chair, but do you have any amendments, or are you just the DE-5 going to be the only amendment?
At this point, the DE-5 is the only amendment.
I would just wish you would offer them. I mean, during this time, rather than wait till tonight, so we have time to react if there is one.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I hope that we will email. If there is another amendment, we will email those to you in plenty of time for you to read them. If you need some more time, we can, you know, recess for a later period of time. But if there's another amendment, you will get them in plenty of time.
And just so there's no misunderstanding, we naturally would be asking for a roll call vote at the final act.
I would assume so.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative Paymar, welcome to your committee.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I guess I need some help here, too. So, Representative Hillstrom, this will go to the Judiciary Committee as it stands. Is that?
As it stands, Mr. Chair.
When the DE-5 amendment is put on, just trying to get the right motion here.
That would be correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chair, then I would move the DE-5 amendment to get in the shape that I want it, and then I'll go through that that amendment.
Need to move the bill first, I believe.
I will move that House File 237 be passed and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
And
now I'd like to move the DE-5 amendment to get it in the shape that I want it.
Does everybody have the DE-5 amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Against? Motion passes. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that this is a complicated issue, and this has been a contentious issue for you in the Public Safety Committee, and a contentious issue in our state, as it is across the country as we deal with this issue of gun violence. And I would be the first to say, and I really have to say, I appreciate the respectful way that you treated this issue and the respectful way that this committee has treated the public who came here. And during 3 days of testimony, I think that's that says a lot about the work that we get done here and the process that we undertake. Again, there are no easy solutions. As you know, mass shootings have rocked our country, and we seek solutions to that. And you know, we don't have all of the answers, and this bill is only part of the answer. We know that there are individuals with mental illness. There are people with grudges. We know that there's easy access to firearms. We know that we have problems with a lack of security in some of our buildings. And we know that there's a glorification of violence in this country. We just heard yesterday that there was an incident in Florida at a college that could have been horrible. where someone had amassed, a student had amassed weapons and ammunition and had fully intended to kill many people on a campus in Central Florida. That's not going away, unfortunately. We know all too well about the gun violence in our neighborhoods. Again, we seek solutions. There are domestic abuse cases where the perpetrator fears when the victim leaves the household that the relationship is over and he takes it out on her. And we've seen that all through this state all too often. We know that there are disgruntled workers. We know that we have a gang problem. We know that the concentration of poverty in our neighborhoods is problematic, and we also know that there's easy access to weapons. So again, gun violence prevention and this bill is a multifaceted approach, and this bill is only one piece of the puzzle. We need more funding for mental health treatment and assessment. We need better security strategies, and we need laws and a state and on the state and national level to ensure that guns stay out of the hands of people who shouldn't possess them. Members, I just want to say a couple more things, and then I'm going to go through the bill. There are 12,000 firearm homicides a year in this country. There are 18,000 firearm suicides a year in this country. At least 116 children have been shot to death in Minnesota, and hundreds more injured. And this is not just a metro issue. The evolution of the Gun Violence Prevention Act happened after the Newtown tragedy. It's not a new issue here in Minnesota. The press asked me, as the incoming chair of this committee, what I thought about the Newtown tragedy, and I thought it was appropriate that we hold hearings. And in fact, if the only bill that I had heard of at the time was one on renewing the assault weapons ban and the bill by Representative Cornish on allowing teachers to carry in schools. And at the time, I thought we should hear Representative Cornish's bill, and we should hear all bills related to gun violence. And that's what we did. We sat through 3 days of hearings. We heard 10 bills, and we ended up with the Gun Violence Prevention Act. And what's in this bill? I'm going to get into the specifics, but there are no bans in this bill. The centerpiece of this bill is universal background checks to keep pistols and semi-automatic military assault weapons, which is the way we define them in statute, out of the hands of disqualified people. And who are those disqualified people? They're felons, they're domestic abusers, and they're people who have been civilly committed for serious mental illness. What this bill does is it expands background checks to gun shows, to people who purchase in-state over the internet, and to private sales. Now, we can argue the research that states that 40% of sales in this state and in this country of handguns and semi-automatic military assault weapons do not get background checks. Some would say that that's a high number. But that's 6.6 million weapons that are purchased without background checks in this country a year. So if it was 30% or it was 20%, I don't know. That's still millions of purchases without background checks. In this bill, I tried to compromise. Again, we kept the bans out. There were concerns that if we required background checks, that relatives wouldn't be able to sell their firearm to other relatives. And we put an exclusion in to make sure that that was covered. Again, we're only dealing with handguns or semi-automatic military assault weapons. And the claim that background checks don't work, to me, is false. And you will probably hear that today. But remember, since the Brady Bill was passed, nearly 2 million people have been blocked from possessing firearms who were disqualified from owning them. Almost 2 million people. This issue is not going to go away. House File 237 is the right bill. The public supports this. Over 70% in all of the polling data that you look at in Minnesota, Republican, Democrat, rural, metro, law enforcement, Governor Dayton supports this bill. It's passed out of the Senate committee. and I'm asking you to pass this out of this House committee so we can bring it to the House floor. With that, members, I want to briefly go through the bill with you, and just so you can see the sections that are new from what you heard several weeks ago. So, members, on the DE5 amendment, I'm just going to go through these quickly, and just so you're clear about what has changed and what this bill does. Section 1 of the bill just provides the need for information for applying for a permit to purchase. You will also see that it requires an applicant for a permit to purchase to submit to getting an ID. And again, Mr. Diebel and Mr. Cleary here are experts on this, and they can answer some of your questions also. But Section 2 of the bill talks about the disqualifying factors for getting a permit to purchase from a police chief or a sheriff, and those, again, disqualifying factors are being a felon, domestic violence, civilly committed for mental illness. There are other factors that disqualify, but those are the major ones. It has some provisions in here that were worked out with the police chiefs and law enforcement who wanted this language in this bill, and I think it's very important. It allows the chief of police to decide if somebody is at risk to themselves or to others that they can deny a permit to purchase. And law enforcement will testify in a few minutes here about the importance of this. They know when they go out and there's been domestics or there's been substance abuse or there's been problems at certain households, what kinds of situations potentially could explode. Officers know that. Now, this doesn't just give police chiefs the ability to act arbitrarily or with caprice. They have to document this in their police reports, and then the police chiefs would make that decision about not granting a permit to purchase. It always allows the individual to appeal, but that gives law enforcement more flexibility. Later in Section 2, it talks about the administrative fee. I think this is reasonable that chiefs can charge a $25 fee. It also talks about if police or law enforcement is unable to identify who is applying for the permit to purchase. Section 4 of the bill I'm just trying to get to the high points here that you need to know about. Our changes current references to state or federal laws. Check Section 6 and 7. In Section 7, this is a slight change. It lengthens the time limit for background check from 5 to 7 days. There's more language here about if law enforcement is unable to verify. And Section 8 is also grounds for disqualification. So this is for transfer. If I'm misstating this, Mr. Diebel or Mr. Cleary, this is for the transfer of transferee license permit, I should say. Something else that you should look at is probably on in Section 10. This says that it talks about the mandates to transfer between private parties to be routed through a dealer. So if you were going to sell at a gun show, for instance, again, there's the administrative fee for transferring permits. We have some language here at the end of page 6 that the auctioneers asked for that exempts them from this provision. Section 11 is the language that allows for if you have a permit to carry, you may substitute that for a transferee permit. Again, in Section 12, this is the relative exclusion. And in Article 2 of the bill, which is on page 8, this is the language that came from prosecutors and law enforcement.
Section 2 of Article 2 is the penalties for false reporting, lost or stolen firearms, allows law enforcement to trace that firearm if there's been a crime, and it's also has the penalties for knowingly reporting a weapon to be lost or stolen. Again, this came from prosecutors in the state of Minnesota, as well as in Section 3 of the bill. There's three more violent crimes that have been added to the crime of violence that would then prohibit someone from possessing a firearm, which is felony in the fifth degree, felony domestic assault by strangulation. And just briefly, Mr. Chair, the ammunition in Section 4, again, came from the prosecutors. At the bottom of page 10, this clarifies a person who has been committed by the court because of mental illness being ineligible for firearm possession. And let me see what else is. Section 6 of Article 2 clarifies that a person who aids and abets an ineligible person in violating the ban of possession, and the penalty section then comes in Section 7. It adds a new gross misdemeanor and a felony for repeat violators. And Mr. Chair, I think that's the bill or the things that I, so again, the I'm happy to answer any question or stand for questions on the bill, and Mr. Diebel and Mr. Clary can answer specifics also.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Paymar, you and I have always been up front with each other, and we've gotten along pretty good together through this thing. I would like to hit about 6 or 7 points and then end up with a question, so if you don't mind. I don't think this is your last shot at this bill. This bill is too horrible to make it out of committee, and so I got a feeling you're going to offer some amendment to water it down here before this time is over. But I just want to let you know that the GOP members here stand strong in defense of the Second Amendment, and hopefully at least two of your members also. I think this is a wrong attack on the thing that does the least amount of harm on gun shows, the least avenue for guns to make it into crimes. I think that the statistics show that 3% or less of the guns and crimes come from gun shows, and that statistic that it's 40% or whatever it is that don't get background checks, I think has been proven wrong many times by studies. And you're right, it depends on which study you turn up. Nowadays on the internet you can turn up a study for just about anything, but these facts came from the Department of Justice and other governmental agencies. I don't think it was a loophole. We call this a gun show loophole. I don't believe it is. I believe it was planned that way. I don't think that private sales or gun shows were ever intended to be covered. So it's not a loophole. It's the exclusion on purpose. I remember when the peace officer came and a couple of years ago, maybe last year, and they claimed that all the guns that they had blocked from purchase, but not one place in that testimony did he say it ever stopped a crime. So that statistic is pretty misleading. All these people you stop from getting guns, there's no proof whatsoever how much crime that actually stopped. And so it sounds like a good figure. The 70% poll. I did a lot of polling when I was president of the union, the Conservation Officers Union. In fact, one of the polls we sent out showed that 70% of the peace officers and game wardens didn't want any form of gun control or thought that it did any good. And I know that if I write the poll question, I can get just about any answer I want. So when the Star Trib came out with that poll, it seemed really foolish to me, because the question they asked, I would maybe even ask yes to a certain part of it with no facts or background on explaining, you know, what universal background checks were and how there was a fee and how it would be a gateway to registration and a number of other things. So I think that was a weird poll, and it depends on how much faith you put in polls. Since you brought the poll question up, the Star Trib also ran a poll on gay marriage, and they said that the majority of the people that responded were not in favor of gay marriage. Well, then the left came out the next day, and a number of bloggers and well-known institutes said that their statistics prove that the majority of Minnesotans did approve of it. So It depends on how much faith you put in polls nowadays. The chiefs and the sheriffs having more authority in your bill about a vague authority, how they can refuse a permit. I'm really uncomfortable with that, and most gun owners are. The main point in our bill, a permit to carry that I was the author of a few years ago, put it this way for a reason, because of the abuses that were taking place. And I think I have more fear of the chiefs making the decision than I do the sheriffs, because obvious what's happened in the last few months. And the other problem I have is that the chiefs have testified just about against every gun bill that I've had so far. And if they were elected like the sheriffs, I think that you would get a lot different. Rather than talking for city councils and mayors, I think that you would get a lot different response from your chief. Some of the parts of your gun bill I have a problem with is the dealer. If you have to find a dealer and take the gun to the dealer, if you find a dealer, then it says that the dealer is supposed to take the gun. I don't know how you wind up out in the country at some federal firearms dealer with the buyer and the seller, and then you don't make it through a background check, which happens sometime by mistake. Heaven help the man that tries to take my firearm at that point and turn it over to law enforcement. So I have a real problem with that. And then also, we put a definite time limit because we wanted one. And now you've got a place in here that can extend the time period. So to me, no disrespect to you, but the bill is a nightmare for gun owners. And I can't see any portion of it that we can stand to survive on of your proposals. We had a proposal out there that was supported by prosecutors and sheriffs and thing, and I probably at some time we used the rather vernacular dressing up a pig. We could put some portions of yours on ours, but it wouldn't make any difference. And so I have a problem with the recess, and a question for you, I guess, would be that during this recess, if you would let DFL members think on their own and give me a guarantee that you or DFL leadership wouldn't badger any more of your DFL representatives into voting for this bill, and let people vote on their own and their own conscience. And good luck to you, and thank you for the courtesy that you've shown me and back and forth. I think we did good on this bill and getting both sides out. But I just hope that there's a good roll call vote and there's no shenanigans that take place between now and 6 p.m. Thank you.
Representative Paymar.
Can I respond to a few of those?
Representative Paymar.
Okay. First of all, Representative Cornish, there's not going to be any shenanigans. And everybody has to vote their own conscience. I mean, you're right. You and I are diametrically opposed on some of these issues. On other issues, you know, we find common ground, and that's what the legislative process is all about. And I'll return the compliment to you. You've been very respectful and upfront with me, and not just this bill, but, you know, throughout the process here. So everyone here has to make up their own mind. You know, polling data, we're all politicians. We look at it, but that shouldn't be the only thing that that people react to. You have to think about, and I would, you know, I hope that people don't just think about this bill, the Gun Violence Prevention Act, as a caucus position. I hope that you, you know, thoroughly, you know, think it through. Maybe you already have, and do what's right. You know, we all have to look at ourselves in the mirror the next day or when we leave the legislature and say to, and, you know, we have to see what's looking back. And is this, did I cast that bill because it was a political vote? Did I cast that bill because I looked at all of the information and then I made a determination and it was the best that I can do? Again, I unfortunately, Representative Cornish, I don't think that this issue is going to go away. I just brought up what happened in Central Florida. I mean, how do you explain to some little kid and watching television in North Minneapolis gets shot, or some little kid driving with his mom in Oakdale and gets killed? This is real life. It's Minnesota. It's all through the country. And let me just address, Ms. Chair, and this is part of the reason why I wanted some time, so we didn't rush through this, you know, so we can have a discussion even before we vote tonight. You say that the gun show loophole doesn't exist, and I have read
I have read articles about that, and that's the position that the NRA puts out. But let me just say, it does exist. And I want to give you an example. And I want to tell, and I think you know I would never not tell the truth in front of this body. The last time that I had this bill in front of, I don't think it was this committee, we were trying to plug the gun show loophole. And I had that bill, if you remember, and I then amended it on to the game and fish bill that was David Dill had, and he was not too happy about that. But when neither was Speaker Kelleher, and we had a debate about it on the House floor, if you remember correctly. And so this has been going on. This issue has been going on. So to be honest with you, I had not gone to a gun show at that time. I'd never experienced it. So I went to a gun show after that. And I went with a retired Anoka County deputy sheriff. Took me to Anoka. There was a, I'm trying to remember, it was downtown, the main street. It was the armory in Anoka. And, you know, I guess there's a gun show even going on now. We could all take a little field trip over to the state fair. I think there's one going on. We could see for ourselves. But so we went there, and so it was new to me, a new experience. And there was a whole, if you can picture the room, there were all of these tables with all kinds of firearms and people selling and buying and swords and all kinds of interesting things. And we went up to some of the dealers and said, could we buy, you know, this handgun or that semi-automatic weapon? And people said, sure, you know, told us the price, we held them. And, you know, I said, well, I don't have a permit to purchase, you know, you think I could just get this from you? And the licensed dealers said absolutely not. Go to your police chief, go to your sheriff, you get a permit to purchase, come back, happy to sell it, bargain, whatever. But they would not sell it. So I would say to you, Representative Cornish, that the licensed dealers, the FFLs that are at these gun shows, are not going to do anything stupid and get themselves in trouble, and they're going to require that you have a permit to purchase. But then there are all these other side rooms, and we went to one of those side rooms, and there was a guy selling firearms, and I picked up a handgun, and I said to the guy, I said, look, I don't have a permit to purchase. He said, well, how about if I just take a copy of your driver's license and we'll just call it good? Is that a background check, Representative Cornish? Now, I did that as a complete novice, and there were all kinds of tables there of people selling. So there is a gun show loophole, and it is a significant problem. 40%, 30%, 20%, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. But having firsthand experience, I know it exists. So I would just say to you that I don't see this as an attack on Second Amendment rights like you do. If you think that background checks are inappropriate, if you think that they are an infringement on Second Amendment rights, then let's get rid of them altogether. Why even have them? You want to go to Cabela's or Walmart and buy a handgun? Go buy it. You want to go to a gun show? Buy an AR-15? Then just get rid of the gun shows altogether if it's an infringement on Second Amendment rights. That is all we're trying to do. I think that this is a minor inconvenience for a civilized society, and I'll leave it at that. I have some people who would like to testify, Mr. Chair. I don't know if anyone else has comments at this point or questions.
Any questions from members? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Paymar. A question, because I hear this come up a lot, and I heard Representative Cornish refer to this too about we're creating and I think the term was, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but gateway to registration. And I'm just wondering if you can comment on that in terms of current law, and as well as what is proposed here in the House File 237 in terms of what will change and what your thoughts are on what might new be happening in terms of quote-unquote registration.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, Mr. Cleary or Mr. Diebel could also add in here, but I don't see this as a gateway to registration. I know that, some in the NRA believe that this is the slippery slope to that, and it's not. It simply requires that if you're going to go to a gun show and you're going to purchase a firearm, or if you're going to purchase a firearm on the internet or in a private sale, that you need to get your permit to purchase, which is, you know, you would get that through whatever your local law enforcement agency is. It's a 5-day background check where the law enforcement officials will call the BCA and see if there's anything there that they should know about, or the Department of Human Services to see if there's anything there that they should know about. And in addition, that's when the NICS check can take place, which is the federal background check, to see if there's any disqualifying factors in other states. And I would say that, you know, the NICS system is not perfect, but it is there. And like I said, it has stopped almost 2 million people from possessing firearms who are not supposed to. So that's, you know, the gun registration issue is, all we're doing is expanding the background checks to internet sales, private sales, and gun shows. Mr. Diebel or Mr. Cleary, do you want to add to that, or if I'm misstating it, I'd rather people know that.
Mr. Cleary.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, and Representative Simonson, members, House Research sees itself, if I may just preface this statement, as trying to help all of you by providing accurate information. And so let me do that here. And as you know, I'm pretty deaf, so I don't always hear all the nuances of your statement or your question. But I think it would be helpful, Representative Paymar and Representative Simonson, to draw a distinction between two types of background checks. And I thought I heard both discussed here this morning, and that's why I'll feel free to do this. One, indeed, is tantamount to registration, though you could argue the semantics of that. The other is not, and I'll explain. Most of the time when we talk about background checks, and I believe in House File 237, the unamended version, requires that two private parties, say the two of you, for example, if you want to sell a gun to Representative Paymar, that the two of you would have to go to a federally licensed dealer, and at that time you would essentially transfer that firearm to the dealer and provide information to the dealer, so that in this case, Representative Paymar, being the buyer, would have to fill out Form 4473, the FBI's form, with all the personal information, and then swear to each element of the prohibition on firearms ownership, swear that that does not apply to you. He has not been dishonorably discharged from the military, for example, or committed or convicted as a felon, et cetera, et cetera. And then that would serve as the basis for the National Instant Check System check by the FBI. So the dealer would pick up the telephone, call the FBI, and within a matter of minutes be able to relate the applicant's information to the FBI, along with an identifying serial number and characteristics of the firearm being purchased. And the FBI would do the quick computer check using Minnesota's information and every other state's information. Now, the reality is that's not perfect and complete information. Minnesota is pretty good about providing that information. Some states are not nearly as good. And even in the best of circumstances, it's not perfect. But it's the best the world has right now, best the country has too. And so that background check is made. Representative Paymar, being a lawful, law-abiding, upstanding citizen, would be approved, and the dealer would be given a number, an approval number. I forget the formal name. He would write on the application, And he would put that paper copy of the application in his records by law. He must keep that. And he must also go to his log book and log it in. But he must keep it for 20 years. Now this system hasn't been in effect for 20 years, so it's conceivable Congress would extend that and make it lifetime or permanent, just absolutely permanent. Thus, if that firearm that you have sold him, well, thus first of all, I would submit that that's a form of registration. It's not in the government's hand, and the FBI, for the most part, is prohibited by law from keeping that information on record. Now, they can do some auditing of, let's say, Cabela's, if you take it to a dealer at Cabela's. They can do some auditing for a period of time, I think 60 days, take all of those, and then audit them, come out to Cabela's and audit them and so on. And then they must throw it away, unless you do two pistols within a five-day period, that gets kept permanently. So there are some ways, and they've been caught violating that law somewhat under a past attorney general and keeping some of those records not lawfully. So that is a system of registration, and I would submit, and the government can come with some law changes, some federal law changes, can come at virtually any time and take that information and theoretically use it to identify lots more gun owners than you could today. Lots more gun owners, whether it's 40% of sales or a whole lot less than that, I don't know either. I don't think anybody really knows. But they can already do that for new firearms or any other firearms that Cabela sells and or any dealer sells. They would then be able to do it for these person-to-person transactions as well. Now, there's another type of transfer, and I want to tell you about that because not because it's been discussed a lot, but the concept has been out there for several years, and it doesn't get much discussion. And it would not be a registration system, and I'll keep it short. But the that type would be, if you and Representative Paymar, however you get together, by knowing each other, by reference, or by the internet, choose to make a transfer. Let's say, again, you're selling a firearm to Representative Paymar, a pistol or a black gun. You would keep a bill of sale, and that bill of sale might end up looking like a lot like the form 4473 that the FBI uses, simply because it's an easy form to use, it's very complete, and it's used in all our background checks now, whether it's made by the dealer through the FBI or by the police chief through the FBI or the sheriff through the FBI. But if the two of you kept a bill of sale and you kept copies of it and proved each other's identity up front, even if you didn't know each other, that would be a transfer that would not involve what I would call a registration, simply because only the two of you would have it. Now, if under that kind of a system, the FBI would, let's say this firearm were found years later.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Clare, that was very helpful, but you're adding a concept that's not in this bill. This is sort of an idea that's been floated out there. Is that correct?
I thought I heard both mentioned today, but that's right.
It's not in the bill. I just want to be clear that we don't have a lot of time now. So I don't know if you could, that concept is not in the bill.
That's right, and I'm essentially finished, but thank you for your patience.
It's not a bad idea, but it's not in the bill.
Any other questions from members?
Mr. Chair, then Paymar. I would like if law enforcement, if I could have Mr. Flaherty and Petya come up first, and then I have some other proponents of the bill.
Well, welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Yes, members, for the record, my name is Denny Flaherty, and I'm executive director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And I'm here again today, as I was some weeks back, to speak in favor of Representative Paymar's House File 237. I don't want to repeat the testimony that I provided, but I really do want to just leave a couple thoughts. Number one, I believe, and the majority of Minnesotans believe, that if we're serious about reducing gun violence, backgrounding, strengthening our ability to background individuals is really the centerpiece for all of the gun-related legislation that's been introduced this session. And we are in support of this bill because it allows for that, as well as it addresses a concern that we have about straw purchases, which means having eligible people purchase handguns for ineligible individuals. And it gives, this bill gives the police a greater ability to deny a pistol when there's demonstrated and substantiated behavior that flags concerns. I would just simply point out, if you remember the Brooklyn Park officer that was down, that said that he had refused a permit to purchase a handgun, who just months prior had called their department when officers went and had to take her into custody after she was had taken steps to commit suicide. And at the time she said, if I had a gun, I'd blow my brains out. And of course she was taken into custody because the officers were concerned about her her welfare, and she was transported to a hospital. Months later, here she was back in the Brooklyn Park Police Department wanting to purchase a handgun. There are many, many, many cases like that throughout our state, and we need to be able to prevent people like that from getting guns, at least at that time. Maybe some months later and things change with them, maybe their ability to become eligible can change. But members, this is what the people in Minnesota want. They want the police to background people. They want the police to make sure that only eligible people are having access to these weapons. This morning we're downplaying polls, but unfortunately I do believe in polls, although I always want to see who did them and the questions and so forth, like Representative Cornish pointed out. But the polls all support Representative Paymar. KSDP's poll here in Minnesota recently, I believe, was 75%. Pew Research Center back in January, I think we would certainly see them as legitimate, 85% on a national poll. And CBS New York Times, 92%. They all expect law enforcement to be doing something in this area, and we can't. We don't have the laws. Clearly, backgrounding does work. We have been doing this since, what was it, 1979, I think, if I'm not mistaken, when Minnesota passed its first background and waiting period. We were one of the first in the nation to do that, and it has worked. There have been many individuals that have been denied the permit or the ability to go out and purchase handguns. And clearly, we believe that if you want to buy a handgun or a military assault weapon, that it should be expected that you need to prove your eligibility. And so without belaboring it, I do seriously believe that this is the way we need to go. If we are serious, if we're not serious about it, then we can just call it a day on the legislation. But, if we don't believe that criminal laws deter people, then I don't know what the purpose all of you exist for here in this room. Because clearly, people do abide by laws. So this notion that if we pass this, that the criminals aren't going to abide by it. Well, that could be said about everything from speeding to virtually every crime that you parade here in this room. And with that, I would just like to close and lend our strong support on this effort and hope that you can see your way clear to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flaherty. State your name for the record, please. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Peacha. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. And we're here to testify in support of Representative Paymar's Gun Violence Prevention Act. There's been a lot of discussion about the universal background checks, both for closing the gun show loophole and addressing the private sales, specifically for pistols and semi-automatic military assault weapons. But we also support it because it includes a straw purchaser's language and also includes the county attorney's provisions, which would enhance the penalties for individuals that are involved in felony domestic violence. It keeps guns away from juvenile offenders, and it keeps the ammunition away from criminals. But most importantly, today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the background checks that would be conducted by the police chiefs and sheriffs. This bill allows extra time to investigate the eligibility of a permit to purchase or transfer applicant. Oftentimes there are questions of proper identification, there's residency requirement questions, as well as potential issues with the applicant's backgrounds. This most often occurs when the applicant moved to the chief's community from another state or city, and the 7 business days are reasonable, and for those applications that become problematic, the proposed 30 days has been deemed reasonable by our members. This bill allows the use of documented calls of service to law enforcement that identify the applicant for a permit to purchase or transfer as a danger to themselves or others. This would be a disqualifying factor when considering the application. We support the use of this information as a critical part of determining whether an individual is eligible to purchase a pistol or semi-automatic military assault weapon. The language that you see in this bill was negotiated with NAMI, other members of law enforcement, and your committee counsel was also present to assist us with the language. So I am here today to support Representative Paymar's Gun Violence Prevention Act. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
So, Mr. Chair, I think we have about 15 minutes for proponents, and then we could allow for opponents to, if there's any opponents that want to speak. So, I guess
Mr.
that's
Chair, the question.
Representative Cornish.
I just want to, after the law enforcement testified, I just wanted to make note of who isn't here today. Minneapolis PD, who left the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association years ago, their director of Minneapolis PD chided Mayor Ryback for jumping on the gun control bandwagon. Also not here today is the Sheriff's Association. Just so you don't think that when they say law enforcement backs this, that they mean all law enforcement. Thank you.
Representative Paymar, any more testifiers?
Yes, I do have testifiers.
We have about 13 minutes left.
Good morning.
Good morning. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Angel Cradle. My son, Dwayne's life was threatened 2 weeks before he was murdered. The perpetrator murdered my son in cold blood with no remorse, shot him twice in the back and torso area. This, for me, was a devastating act of unnecessary gun violence. This has changed my entire life, and along with my son dying, a part of myself died as well, and that I will never get back. My son left 2 sons behind who will never have their father to nurture them and watch them grow. This has affected my entire family. 6 months after the perpetrator was stopped, on a traffic stop, they found him not only with the weapon that murdered my son, but several other weapons in his possession. This tells me guns are rampant in our communities. Is it no wonder because so many sales require no background check at all? Stopping some of this violence requires the policymakers to recognize the fact that gun violence destroys lives every day in our community and in our communities all across the state. I miss my son. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and we're sorry for your loss. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Julia Freeman. I'm with the Organizing Apprenticeship Project, but I'm here today as well as someone who lost a loved one. My son-in-law was killed March 11, 2012, so it's just a year anniversary. He was a hardworking father of seven children and a loving husband. He was a self-made businessman and the sole provider for my daughter and her children. He was killed tragically by a young man he was trying to mentor, his best friend's brother, who had a gun when he was visiting his friend, and he was walking out the door, and this young man shot him. And after he was found to have done that and got out on bail, 2 weeks after that, he was caught with another handgun. Now, I believe that this bill will keep those kind of guns off the street. And even if it is only 3%, I bet my life on that 3% because I don't want another person to lose a loved one. Also, this is a bill that we consider at the Organizing Apprenticeship Project as a racial justice bill. This is part of our bill watch. All of the legislators got one. So we're watching this closely, and we hope that you will vote correctly today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Kathleen McCosco. I'm pastor of Stadium Village Church, a conservative church of the Presbyterian Church USA. We are located across the street from the University of Minnesota's residence halls, where even a one-block walk alone in daylight or dark promotes fear of armed theft, beatings, and abductions, all of which have happened to students in the past few years. The Presbyterian Church USA has adopted a policy at their National General Assembly meeting in 2010, which happened to be held in Minneapolis, which agrees with this gun violence prevention bill. Our church wants this bill to pass. We want you to stop our culture of fear and death. The international students at our church appreciate living in America, but they are appalled at our gun policy. Please put rationality back into our society by voting for this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Pastor Harding Smith, pastor of the Spiritual Church of God in Brooklyn Center and president of Minnesota Acts Now in Minnesota. I'm very glad and honored to be here today. I'm saddened regarding the trend that have gripped our community. Our community have been ravaged by gun violence. As a pastor of the people, I have been to just about every single murder scene in Minneapolis the past year. I was just called to do the funeral for two young men that got murdered at 39 in Fremont about a week ago. All we are asking is for a common sense law that works. Our children are our treasure. We need to protect our children. At the end of the day, if you are staring down the barrel of a gun, what's the difference? We want to work on prevention. Giving criminals more time in prison, it's not going to help the grieving family. We need to come together as a community. We have too many children that are going to be fatherless this year in Minnesota. A lot of you have not seen what I've seen. It's a war out there. We need to come together and do something. Those little kids at Sandy Hook, they didn't sign up for this. Our children need to be safe going to schools. We need to protect them. Now is the time. Thank you.
Thank you, Reverend. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Sure. Excuse me. My name is Gene Martin, and I pastor a church in North Minneapolis called Joint Heirs with Christ Faith International, and I support the bill for background checks, and as well as our church And in my church, there's a minimum of 3 mothers who've lost their sons to gun violence, a father who's lost his son, and scores of members who've lost their family members and their loved ones. And we support the bill because we believe that if we can just keep as many guns off the streets that are illegally going to our young people as possible, it would save lives. And that's what it's all about. It's about saving our young people's lives. It's about saving anyone's life. And it's not only things that's happening in inner city Minneapolis, but all Minneapolis, St. Paul, but all over the state of Minnesota. There's far too many killings, and we just support this bill for background checks. And I'd like to say this. Some say that you can't save everyone, and we know that we can't. But the life that you save could be your own. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have about 5 minutes left for proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Jason Adkins, and I'm in here today on behalf of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, which is sponsored by the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the Jewish Community Relations Council, the Minnesota Council of Churches, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. Since the early 1970s, faith communities sponsoring the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition have called for common sense regulations designed to lessen gun-related injuries and deaths, and therefore we strongly support Representative Paymar's Gun Violence Prevention Act, which includes universal background checks for the possession of certain types of weapons. There's a public interest in making sure guns are used safely and transferred safely. We believe state regulations related to the sale and the proper use of guns are an appropriate means of ensuring that the right to own guns is exercised by people qualified and capable of exercising that right responsibly. In houses of worship all over Minnesota, people pray for peace. This includes prayers that the people of Minnesota, both individually and collectively, find effective and creative ways to curb gun-related injuries and deaths. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, comment and a question
Chair?
For the witness. The question for the witness.
No, Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that this is not going against the time for the proponents because there's a few people that want to say. So I
absolutely, Representative Paymar. Oh. Representative Cornish.
Just a quick comment. I don't have much in common with JRLC. It's a fairly liberal organization. I'm a Missouri Synod Lutheran. Just a question. What do you think that Jesus meant in the Luke on the New Testament when he said, sell your cloak and buy a sword? The reason I ask that question is we always get pastors coming up here playing the moral card on us and say we have to pass a bill, and when I think that Jesus would have been in a plenty in support of protecting his family with violence if he had to. So I just kind of wondering where this moral thing is coming from in the JRLC and why you're making this statement about why you think it's... Just go ahead and answer the question.
Mr. Adkins.
Representative Cornish, members of the committee, Representative Cornish, I wouldn't deign to question your expertise in Scripture nor engage in such a debate with you here in this chamber, but I can tell you that the communities that sponsor the JRLC believe strongly in peace, that peace is a fundamental contention of each of our belief systems, and that we should be looking at common sense measures that promote a safer society and allow people to be free from fear.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of this committee, I'm the Reverend John Gutterman, co-chair of the Minnesota Conference United Church of Christ Justice and Witness Team. Following the slaughter of the innocents at Connecticut Sandy Hook Elementary School, another UCC pastor, the Reverend Yvonne Delk, said it is time for moral outrage at the death of our children and moral action that will create the public policy needed to interrupt this violence. She concluded saying the time for this is now and it is urgent. Recognizing this urgency, the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Conference for the first time ever approved a strategic alliance with another organization, Protect Minnesota. Now we need you to share our urgency and our moral outrage. We need you to support legislation mandating universal background checks. We need you to join the movement to prevent the next massacre of the innocents. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have about 3.5 minutes left for proponents. And if members don't mind, we will go over for about 5 minutes to give the opponents the same amount of time.
Just
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Rebecca Lowen. I'm a mother and a member of Sheer Tikva's Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. Last week, our task force, with the help of MoveOn.org, created a petition online that calls for universal background checks for all gun purchases. This is the petition so far. In less than a week, it has been signed by 2,700 Minnesotans from all over the state. I'd like to take a few seconds to read some of the comments. Rebecca of Minneapolis writes, as an emergency department nurse at Hennepin County Medical Center for 20 years, I have seen too much gun violence. We need background checks now. From Scott of Duluth, I'm a hunter and a gun owner and have several guns to sell, but this just makes sense. Maybe a bit more of a hassle, but if it prevents the death of just one kid, it is worth it. Nancy of Wilmer, background checks are not an infringement on our rights. It is the right thing to do to help protect innocent people. From Jane of New Hope, the NRA would like us to believe that it won't make a difference. If we save one life, it's a difference. And finally, Judy of St. Cloud wrote, come on, this is common sense. Minnesota can lead the way past this.
Thank you for your testimony, and welcome to the committee. We have about a minute left, so if you keep your comments short.
Thank you. My name is Tasha Rosenfeld-Kellen. I'm also a lifelong resident of Minneapolis, the mother of two young girls, and a member of the Sheer Tikva Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. Along with other members of the Sheer Tikva Violence Task Force, I stand before you representing a broad religious coalition, including Protect Minnesota's Anti-Violence Coalition, Jewish Community Action, and National Council of Jewish Women. In the words of our rabbi, Michael Latz of Sheer Tikva, we advocate for universal background checks because they help us create a safer world for our children. We are called by Jewish tradition, Uvcharta b'chayim, to affirm the sanctity of human life whenever possible. At this moment, politics are the vehicle, but our mission is spiritual and our vision is biblical, to create a world that respects the dignity and worth of every human being. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Paymar, is there anyone that you want to testify in particular, or should we go on to opponents?
Maybe just one final, and if the opponents want to take some additional time. Is this enough, opponents? I think we said 20 minutes, so we're good. Is there anybody? Go ahead.
Well, welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Mary Lewis Groh, here on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Minnesota to express strong support for House File 237, improving the Minnesota system of background checks before gun purchases. The League of Women Voters is a statewide organization, nonpartisan, whose positions are taken after extensive study and consensus of our members. The gun lobby would have you believe that all we need is stricter enforcement of the gun laws we already have. But as a January New York Times article pointed out, and I quote, better enforcement does not help when there is no underlying statute. We do not have the statutes we need to keep guns out of criminal hands. Before you today is proposed legislation to address the gaping holes in existing law. Martin Luther King Jr. said, the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. And we are at such a time. People become disillusioned with government when they believe lawmakers give more weight to lobbyists and representatives of the special interests than to the public's interests. Your vote on House File 237 will reflect whose voices and whose interests you heed.
Thank you.
Chair, I guess we have one more and then we're done.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Phil Moore. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. I'm a hunter, I'm a gun owner, and in the past for over 10 years I taught firearm safety in the state. Began hunting when I was 10 on my grandfather's farm out in Wright County. And I've had a hunting license in Minnesota every year since 1971. That's the year I got out of the Army. hunted all over the state, and I'm here to say not all gun owners are opposed to reasonable firearm legislation. Universal background checks is reasonable legislation. I support it. It is necessary, and it's the right thing to do. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Now we'll give 20 minutes to opponents of the bill. 23 minutes, stand corrected. Welcome to committee. Could you state your name for the record,
Chairman,
please?
Chris Rager with the National Rifle Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak this morning. I appreciate Chairman Paymar's passion for this legislation, but I think it's wrong, and the NRA won't stand silently by. We will continue to fight on this. I think what hasn't been mentioned here is the contacts from Minnesotans around this state that have stood up and opposed Representative Paymar's legislation. I think it's unfortunate that folks turned out today to see this committee hearing and hear the testimony and hear a vote, and then we're going to postpone this till 7 o'clock tonight. And what wasn't said is there's a wrangling behind the scenes to try to bully members into voting for a watered-down version of this bill to try to keep this gun control vehicle alive, and I think that that's unfortunate. I think it's also important to note that there is a bill that's been introduced out there by Representative Hillstrom and Senator Ortman that has over 100 members of both the House and Senate as co-sponsors, and it's legislation that would be a real solution and actually gets things done. What hasn't been said about Representative Paymar's legislation is, in addition to the waiting periods and the fees, it does nothing to improve the gaps in reporting of information to strengthen the background check system. It does nothing to help the reporting of the mental health adjudications that prohibit somebody from possessing a firearm. And I think that that's unfortunate. Those are provisions that are in the Ortman and Hillstrom bill, and I would encourage members to look at that legislation and look at crime control versus gun control. And the NRA continues to oppose this bill, and I look forward to working with members of the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. We're here. Representative Lesch.
I just had a question, and I know we can wait till later on this, but this is the second time I've heard an allusion to a bullying effort go around. Representative Cornish mentioned something that the DFL leadership is bullying people, and Mr. Rager just mentioned there's some bullying going on. Can we get clarification? Who is doing the bullying, and who is being bullied?
Representative Lesch, to our knowledge, no one is being bullied.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I didn't ask you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch, I would ask you to ask Representative Paymar and maybe other members of the body. I have been told by members that that is taking place, and I won't be disclosing that information.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
The committee process is a fact-finding process. And to the best of the extent possible, we get names, dates, incidents. And when the record is reflected on this bill in years to come, it's very important we be very specific about who did what so we can make proper decisions. So to the extent that there are allusions to bullying, I need to know what they are, and we need to make decisions about those on the record. So I would ask that future members or future testifiers, if they say anything about this, that they be specific about it. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Rob Dorr with the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. A lot's been made out about the background checks. There was a report that went around that said that 99% of Minnesotans live within 10 miles of an FFL dealer. And something I think it's important to realize is that an FFL dealer is under no obligation to process a background check for a third party. A lot of FFL dealers are manufacturers, so they don't deal in any transfers whatsoever with it, you know, in regard to sales. A lot of people have become FFL so that they can receive and ship guns themselves, so that they can order guns. They're private collectors and things like that. They could go through that extensive process. But furthermore, when you're adding a $25 maximum, you're putting an imposition on a private party. The government is saying you can't charge more than $25. There are a fair number of FFLs that have stood up and said, we're not going to handle this. So you're disenfranchising people only law-abiding citizens, because as you know, the criminals aren't going to abide by these background checks. The Department of Justice study showed that of a study of 18,000 criminals that had been convicted of crimes, only 0.7% of those guns came from a gun show. The vast majority are stolen. They're taken on the black market, bought from friends. I would encourage this body to look at where guns are coming from and address the problem there. Address criminals using guns. You have a bill that's out there that does that. This bill does not. We'll yield the rest of our time. We would encourage you guys to use this time and vote right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that wishes to testify against this bill? Come up, please. Both. Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Beverly Moreland. I live in Cottage Grove, and Dan Schoen is my rep. And I'm very, very much against this. And a lot of the neighbors are, too. And I have sent you something saying that we are against it. And I got a immediate email back saying, well, if you put your name and address on, I will respond. My name and address was on it. But all you guys took an oath of office to defend and support the Constitution. By even discussing this, you are going against your oath. And that really pisses me off. I study the Constitution every week. And you guys are going against your oath of office. And you shouldn't be in office if you can't keep your oath. And I keep hearing things brought up about, oh, if it can save one life. Well, if you're so worried about saving a life, stop the abortions here.
Excuse me. Can we
thank
keep?
Thank you.
Let's keep on topic, please. Welcome to the committee.
Will do.
State your name for the record.
Thank you, sir. My name is Michael Undlin. I live in Plymouth, Minnesota. I have lived in Minnesota all of my life. My concern, one of my concerns that I'll focus on, has to do with the definitions in the language versus some of the talk in the opening comments about what the language maybe meant, and I just maybe need clarification before I even comment. Under paragraph 3, it says a person who has ever been confined or committed in Minnesota who is mentally ill to a treatment facility. and it strikes out the language associated with judicial determination. It wipes out the due process clause. Then on subdivision 4, in terms of restoration, again, it strikes out the judicial determination clause, and it references if somebody's been committed for having been hospitalized or confined based on mental illness. 7 years ago, I suffered a horrible, violent act against me and suffered post-traumatic stress disorder, and I put myself in the hospital. And if the language is what it seems to read, as well as the language associated with some of the legal notes that describe any 72-hour hold, any hospitalization, then effective August 1st, unless I dispossess myself of my hunting rifle, I become a criminal under this statute. And I'm just wondering for clarification, with Representative Paymar describing it being limited to civil commitment, which requires judicial determination, what, for the record, for the voting committee and for the public, is the legislative intent so that that becomes clear in case a judge has to review if I decide not to dispossess myself of a gun and fight this?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I don't think, you know, this is a time for public testimony. If he makes a comment, I could try to, I can answer that question offline and with the...
Isn't it important to know what the legislative intent relative to whether this requires civil commitment, as was stated in the opening remarks, or does not require civil commitment, as the language
and the associated.
Mr.
Chair, if Mr. Debo wants to, I'm not even sure what section of the bill you're referring to.
Paragraph 4.
What section of the bill?
Well, it's on the second page. Item number 2.3, or I'm sorry, paragraph 3. It doesn't require ordered commitment. It doesn't require judicial determination. It just says if I walk
myself
into
the hospital.
Excuse me,
you'll go through the chair, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, over here.
Representative Lesh.
The testifier's request of the author to state our legislative intent is not properly considered as legislative intent under State v. Murphy. That is taken as a product of the whole of committee discussion at the time. And so any comment made by Representative Paymar would not satisfy any questions from the testifier. It's just going to have to come out in the wash of all the discussion throughout the committee at the time.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. And to the testifier, I ask that you speak to Representative Paymar offline at this point.
Okay. One last question, and that is just as a citizen looking at this bill, wondering whether or not I will become a criminal on August 1st, I think it would be important for the bill to be clear so that I would know whether or not to make a very difficult decision before midnight on August 1st.
I understand. I think you're working off the original bill and not the DE-5 amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, one of the first acts the committee did on this bill was to adopt the DE-5 amendment. And so that's the working version that the committee is considering before us, not the bill as introduced, which was also distributed today, but the DE-5 is the one that should be considered.
Okay, that helps a ton. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to...
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is John Strominger. I'm an Eastside resident. And I live north, the closest house to where Sergeant Vick was shot. And in addition, within a half mile of three other officers. But my point here is about Betty McCollum at a town hall meeting in Oakdale. She made a comment when the topic was broached about do we have a gun control problem or is it a psychopharmaceutical problem, and she answered by saying that there's a CDC rule that she was not allowed to link or study, was her words, any connection of gun mania to medication madness, to quote Dr. Peter R. Bragan's book, and that it frosted her cookies that she was prevented from studying that, but there were powerful lobbies that influenced the debate, and then she changed the subject. This topic has been discussed at the Veteran Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives on February 24th, 2010, and Dr. Peter R. Bragan, you can view that testimony at Bragan.com. Gave a detailed analysis emphasizing the science that demonstrates a causal relationship between the newer antidepressants, the SSRIs, etc., and the production of suicide violence mania, specifically in the military. And as everybody knows, Minnesota has a lot of veterans that have committed suicide. And I just wanted to bring up the mental health issue again, like my fellow citizen, that it needs to be discussed why veterans are killing themselves. And our president said, if there's one thing that we can do, let's do it. And so that's my comment. I thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. After the next testifier, we're going to recess until 7 p.m. tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I first would like to say that I share in everybody's sorrow for all victims of violent gun crimes. I think it's abhorrent. I would just like to raise one question, and we've talked about the slippery slope to registration, and you can call it a gun show loophole, whatever you'd like, but we're basically banning
sorry,
the...
Sorry, did you state your name for the record, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Mark Benokin, and I am a North Minneapolis resident.
Thank you.
I would like to say that by registering every gun sale for private citizens, the only way that you can possibly do that is to establish a baseline. Because otherwise, how would you know whether the gun was transferred prior or after legislation being passed? So unless you register all the guns and know from that moment on who has them, the legislation would be virtually ineffective. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Schoen, did you want to say something?
No, I can wait till later, Mr. Schoen.
Okay. Representative Paymar? Okay, this committee is in recess until 7 p.m. tonight.
Members, the Public Safety Committee will come to order. I appreciate your patience and for the long delay here. I really appreciate your indulgence and all the people from the public who came out to be here today. And I just want to say thank you all. We want to move. We want to keep discussions going on this important issue. And with that, the chair will lay over the DE5 bill as amended. This meeting is adjourned.